I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. My guest today is novelist and publisher Anne Sturzinger. Anne, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
I wanted to interview you first and foremost because you're launching a new project, and so why don't we just jump right in and let you plug away at that, and then we'll do some background.
Well, Rachel Haywire, who's been floating around the same circles, had a idea for a website called Trigger Warning, and she's put out a couple of issues, which is kind of a weird concept in the context of an electronic publication, because it's not like, you know, you bind them and you print them and here's issue 1, 2, and 3, but she's kind of doing them, you know, in issue form. And she'd done a couple of issues more or less on her own, and she sort of wanted to bring me in just to have another editor, to have, you know, someone to do some of the legwork, to use my writing as content. It's pretty obvious from the title of the project, Trigger Warning, that we aren't terribly concerned with people's more delicate sensibilities. Lately I've been sort of playing around with calling myself a radical moderate as opposed to a left winger or a right winger, just because even in the most intellectual circles, people often like to choose teams. And they kind of shut their brain off a little bit and just tend to go with whatever, you know, they'll pick one side and they'll pick the side that they mostly agree with. And then they'll find themselves agreeing with things that they don't quite agree with just because their team agrees with them. And I'm trying to steer myself more in the direction of give me the facts. So, what Trigger Warning is about is it's of course, we're first and foremost dedicated to humor. And using humor as a tool to dissect a lot of the myths that are floating around the internet and these, you know, teams of, I guess social justice warrior is kind of an outdated term, but I think there's still enough comedy value left in squads of social justice warriors running around the internet, witch hunting people to squeeze at least a few more laughs out of it. You know, we're basically planning to go where the hypocrisy and the laughs and the new ideas are insofar as we can.
Well, gee, I didn't even know social justice warriors were old-fashioned. I just started using the term myself only a matter of days or weeks ago. But they're certainly not going to run out of laugh potential anytime soon. One of a new writer for Countercurrents reviewed this book on neo-paganism, and one of the people in the book starts listing his or her credentials. I can't even tell. I can't even remember what sex the person is, or even if I should be using that word. But the person's credentials included, I'm going to just read it to you because it's so damn funny. This person claims, and you know, this is a quasi-academic volume where there's only one person who has any academic credentials. But in the world of the PC, these are credentials. So this person lists his or her credentials as being married, genderqueer, queer, kinky, poly, pagan, female-presenting, AFAB, assigned female at birth, Mexican-American, lower socioeconomic status upbringing, working-class person. And that's pretty impressive to me. That's a real mouthful. And obviously this person, simply because of who they are, have a lot to say. And we should listen to them, right? It's like heavy metal. It's its own parody, I think. So, you know, I wish you the best in dealing with these sorts of people. So how did you meet Rachel Haywire?
You know what? I don't really remember. She's just been floating around, and I've sort of been floating around. And we both happened to be, I sort of happened to be between projects when she mentioned that she wanted somebody to work with her on this. And I was like, you know what? That sounds like a hell of a lot of fun. I really don't recall the first time I heard of her or talked to her. We've just sort of been sort of the flotsam and jetsam of the internet eventually brought the two of us together.
I first heard about you through Nine Banded Books and Chip Smith and your novel Nisqually, which I've read and which I think is extremely well written. I didn't find it pleasant reading, but then I read Céline and Houellebecq too, and I don't read that because it's pleasant. I read that because it's compelling and powerful, and I really thought you, just stylistically, you kept me reading. It's a real achievement. It's an impressive book. How many novels have you written, and how many of them have you published? Do you want to tell us a little bit about your career as a novelist?
Okay, well, first of all, thank you very much. I'm glad to hear you enjoyed it. You put so much time and effort into writing a novel, and then you throw it out in the world, and especially if you're a no-name type person at first, there's just this echoing silence. So eventually hearing that people have enjoyed it is very gratifying. My first novel was called Girl Detectives, and it was pretty rough around the edges. And I finished it sort of in the mid-aughts when the self-publishing revolution hadn't really taken off yet. And also, publishers still wanted you to send in paper versions of your novels. They weren't accepting submissions via email, so it was very expensive to send out a novel and get it rejected 20 times. And that happened to be when at the same time as that I decided to end my career in newspapers. I'd been working at the Chicago Reader for about 5 years, which is, it's a very sort of left-wing publication, and through the whole familiarity breeds contempt mechanism, working there sort of made me thoroughly disgusted with the left, particularly, hypocritical rich kids on the left. And so Girl Detectives was kind of a parody of that milieu. And there's some funny material in it, but it wasn't really well crafted because it was my first attempt. So, and I had decided to quit the newspaper industry and finally go get a college degree, because you used to be able to do all kinds of jobs without a college degree, and all of a sudden, you need a master's degree to move up from toasting buns at McDonald's to frying hamburgers at McDonald's. So I went back to school about the same time I finished that novel, and I just didn't have, because I was a student, I just didn't have the money to send it to be rejected by 50 publishers. So I eventually wound up using one of the more primitive publish-on-demand systems back when Amazon was just starting to do publish-on-demand, and the book was like, it was printed on this giant paper and it weighs 5 pounds. I've really got to do a new edition of that book where I, first of all, edit it, and second of all, get it into a format where it doesn't cost the consumer $20, because that's really not a very good price entry point, especially for a novelist you've never heard of before. Nusquam was my second novel, and I actually sort of wrote it with the encouragement that this was while I was sort of in school. I was finishing up my undergraduate degree in classical letters and French, and I was trying to figure, I was kind of taking a year of being working as a TA and a teaching assistant and trying to figure out whether I wanted to go on and try to get a doctorate in classics eventually. Obviously, the answer was no, but just dealing with undergraduates today is just more of a headache than it's worth. Don't get me started. I mean, it's in the book. There are, since you've read it, there are parts in the novel where, my graduate student protagonist is trying to deal with these incredibly, entitled kids with helicopter parents who are skating through college based on basically threatening the staff with customer service complaints. And that was definitely taken from real life, and that was definitely a reason I went back into writing and editing full time as opposed to going into academia, because I looked ahead and all I could see, at the finish line after I get my PhD is I get to spend 50 more years dealing with these little snots. Like, if that's my prize, I don't think I'm going to go through this. Yeah, I'm in my 30s. I'm finishing my undergrad degree. I'm thinking of going to grad school. I'm not having a very good time dealing with undergrads today, because, wow, they really would rather spend more time studying women's basket weaving and drunk studies than actually get anything out of school. I mean, what you see with the social justice warriors on the internet now is just from working on the internet and dealing with the alt-right and the people who like to attack the alt-right right after, you know, coming out of trying to deal with academia, you know, my view of the whole thing is there are just packs of wild college-age students who really aren't that interested in their schoolwork. They're not working or in the real world yet. And they're just running around trying to make themselves feel important, which, you know, I think that the internet is heavily weighted that way because actual adults are busy, you know, actually doing their jobs, and serious students are busy actually studying. So you get this sort of unbalanced cross section of, you know, people who are basically on a 4-year vacation at taxpayer expense, and the bill hasn't caught up to them yet.
I'm a failed academic, I guess, and I have to say that although I never taught undergraduate students, I know plenty of academics who are still in the game who do. And one friend of mine asked his professors that he had decades ago when he was an undergraduate if they have noticed a decline in the undergraduate students. And they uniformly said, oh my God, it's so terrible. Every year you can see that they notch down a little bit more in preparedness and sort of are bumped up another notch in terms of obnoxiousness, entitlement, distractedness, and so forth, to the point where they just feel like they can't do their jobs anymore because the whole society and the whole previous educational system has failed them so thoroughly. So I can see the desire, you know, to get out of that. It's a front row seat in civilizational decline unless you're at a very, very special elite liberal arts college where everybody just wants to go there and learn, and there are precious few of those left.
So. Yeah, and I think now they're wasting their time on women's underwater basket weaving as well.
It does provide us a lot of targets for satire, that's for sure. And yes, our opponents, the left today, the sort of loud left, are really, really very vulgar and middle-brow, hysterical, uptight, and really unfunny. That's the thing about them that I find most disappointing. They're so unfunny, and I keep wishing that somebody would come along who'd be like a really good opponent. We need better opponents. We'd be blessed with better enemies than these gawker types. And really, the only thing to do is just to mock them because you can't debate them intellectually. They've given up on that, or they never got there, much less gave up on it. They don't even know what the life of the mind would be like, I think. It's just a kind of primitive religious dogmatism wrapped up with this smugness that they're educated.
Yeah, they're educated and they're, you know, they're marching into the quasi-Marxist future. You know, people sometimes object to the term cultural Marxism, but one thing that this, you know, SJW movement or whatever you want to call it has in common with old-fashioned Marxism is that they really think that history, they're atheists, and yet they think history has a narrative, and that narrative is on their side. You know, I forget what the rate was, but since President Obama started using the phrase, you know, history is on our side, like the number of usages of that phrase on the internet has just shot up. And, you know, if you're an atheist, it's this strange kind of doublethink that, no, there's no God in charge of everything, and yet history has a narrative as though someone were writing it, and we're on the right side of it, and you uneducated masses, and, you know, by uneducated they mean they disagree with us, you know, are on the wrong side of history.
It's no longer God is on our side, it's history's on our side, but it's the same kind of mentality.
Yeah.
So you've written 3 novels now, or published 3 novels now. Let's be careful. What's the third novel, and tell us a little bit about that, and then tell us about any work you might have in the can or in planning stages.
Okay. Well, there was Nusquam, and like I said, I wrote that sort of at Chip Smith's behest, because he was like, I'm starting a when he started Nine Banded Books, he was like, I'm starting a publishing company, do you got a manuscript? And I was like, I have the embryo of one, but with your with his encouragement, I really set to work on it. after that was published to the tune of crickets, because of course neither Chip nor I had a lot of money to throw into publicity. So it goes, Newsom has been one of those books that's sort of crept up. After that was published, for 10 years, I've been planning to write a science fiction novel. But contrary to what, your literary fiction New Yorker types claim, writing sci-fi is actually a hell of a lot harder than writing a realistic novel. And you have to do everything that you do in a realistic novel, but you also have to build a world. So I sort of wrote Nusquam as a way of warming up and honing my just plain point-and-shoot, I call them, like my point-and-shoot realistic fiction skills in preparation for this science fiction novel. When I got Nusquam published, I started working on the science fiction novel, but I got stuck at a certain point, and I realized that I still hadn't honed those dialogue, flow, organizing, meta-organizing skills yet. So I put the science fiction project on hold and started writing The Talkative Corpse, which is, it's got a similar protagonist to Nusquam, just sort of a guy who's screwed. I've been asked multiple times, and I've given multiple answers as to why I've been choosing to use male protagonists, even though I'm definitely female. Assigned at birth, presents as, any way you want to put it, I'm a female. And my answer usually runs along the lines of, well, I want to write fiction. I don't want to sort of let my brain funnel me into making excuses for my own bullshit. So the less, you do write what you know. Like I set this story in Chicago in a neighborhood where I live because I know that neighborhood. I know what it's like. I know the kinds of things that happen. I know the architecture. But just to get myself into a more creative space, I just imagined I was someone completely different. And this has worked out really well for me because it keeps me from wasting writing time on justifying my own bullshit, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. And let me just say that I thought that the male protagonist in Nusquam was totally believable as a man. And I think that's impressive. Yeah, the easiest, laziest thing to do is just write a semi-autobiographical novel where it's basically you, the same sex, same gender, same socioeconomic status, set in the present day in your own neighborhood. Yeah, you don't have to create a world. You just have to slightly tweak the details and maybe make your life a little more interesting. That's easy. I can see how science fiction has to be really hard by comparison. But writing, for being a man writing realistic female characters, or being a woman and writing psychologically real male characters, that's difficult. I mean, there's been thousands of years of men and women not understanding each other very well. So you sort of bridged that gap, I thought.
Well, thank you. I have a little motto that I think might eventually become a trigger warning article. And it goes, men and women will never get along, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't try.
Yeah, I like that. That's a good one. So you created your own publishing imprint called Hopeless Books. So tell us a little bit about that. That's an important project. I'm a publisher, so I'm always curious about how new publishing projects get started.
Well, there were kind of two reasons I started it. There was a guy I dated for 10 years whose younger brother was just filled notebooks and notebooks and notebooks with hilarious dialogue. And he's one of those, I've used the term to describe James LaFond. He's sort of a graphomaniac. He just can't stop, writer's block is unheard of for him. He just, whenever he has a lot of sort of psychological problems, and whenever he feels nervous or anxious, he just sits down and writes this hilarious dialogue. And he had no connections in publishing because he's not a very outgoing fellow. But also he had never sat down and compiled it. And one day he finally sent me a compilation, and I was so shocked because for so many years he'd just been sort of spewing this stuff and he'd never compiled it. And the way he finally compiled it was hilarious. Or at least I thought at the time. I was kind of drunk. It was the holidays, I think. And I sort of, I confess, drunkenly agreed to start a publishing company just to publish this book.
Well, that's a good origin story. I like that.
The other reason was I woke up the next morning and I was like, how the hell am I going to publish this book? And then I realized Amazon has now made it possible for you to start your own publishing company with zero overhead. If you know how to edit and you don't have to, you know, hire an editor, you can just take someone's manuscript, edit it. You know, for $10, Amazon will let you register your ISBN number to your own publishing company. So, I mean, I know everyone thinks Amazon is evil and Jeff Bezos is, you know, in it with Obama and the drones and whatnot, but be that as it may, they've created a platform where you can start a publishing company from zero. And, you know, when I woke up with my little tiny hangover and my promise to publish someone's book and you know, it was like the clouds opened up and the angels started singing and I was like, oh my God, you don't need any capital to start a publishing company anymore. This is brilliant.
Well, I totally agree. And yes, Amazon is evil because they booted us out of their affiliate marketing program because of the SPLC making a fuss. But that aside, that personal thing aside, I still buy stuff from Amazon. They still sell the books that we publish. And I do think that their net contribution to freedom of thought is still very high. They're really, really in the black as when it comes to enabling creative people with dissident voices to get through the filters of the New York publishing establishment. And that is a tremendous, tremendous contribution. So bless them all.
Indeed. What exactly did they kick you out of and why?
Amazon has this thing called an affiliate marketing program, and you, being a publisher with a website, need to know about this. But basically, it's simply this. You sign up for an affiliate account. You can do it in 5 minutes. And you can then create links to Amazon products that have your code in it. And if people click the link on your website and buy that product or anything else within like a 24-hour browser cookie window of opportunity, you'll get a commission on the purchases credited to you. And the commissions grow, you know, over time as more things sell. You know, so every month you start at like 3%, and then it goes rapidly up to 7%. Or I think the best month we ever had, we were getting 8% commissions, and we got about $1,000 that month. And of course, the SPLC didn't like this because we were using Amazon affiliate to help fund my life, help keep me in business, and they want me to be poor and not be able to afford to run Countercurrents. And so they created a fuss and they squawked about it for quite some time, and eventually some enabler at the Washington Post actually wrote an article about it, and within a few days after the Post article came out, they shut our program down. It's going to cost me about $6,000 a year in lost revenue, given the level that we were at when they shut it down, which isn't much, but it's enough. You know, it's about 20% of my income, you know, which isn't a lot in absolute terms. But anyway, I'm always the kind of person who takes a crisis and turns it into an opportunity. So my reaction was to get out there and publicize this and use it for fundraising. So I more than made back the money that we lost in terms of sympathy donations and fuck you money. So yeah, it turned out to be an opportunity disguised, I guess, as a crisis. But you, if you have a website and if you're a publisher, you should have this thing in there just in case, you know, people click through and buy books from your site, because sometimes, you know, a person will go on a shopping spree, you know, they'll buy, oh, I want to buy this this hopeless book, and then they'll buy 17 other books or something like that, or it's back to school time and there's a real spree, and you'll end up with 7% of significant amounts of money. One time somebody bought super expensive camera equipment one month, and that was quite a windfall for Countercurrents. So anyway, it's something you need to check out.
Yeah, we did that at Talkies. I you know, every time we listed a book, I would, you know, code in the affiliate link, but I didn't realize how much money you can take in off of that.
Well, if you have a website that has a lot of traffic like Talkies magazine, there's probably a significant amount of money coming in from that. And the SPLC will surely be listening to this. And I'm sure Heidi Beirich is going to set down a donut and open a browser window and send an angry email off to Jeff Bezos, you know, because of this. Well, there's no stopping it now, I guess. It's too late. Taki can take the hit, though, so I can't. But anyway, yeah, so Amazon shut us down, but they're still great. I still love them. I still buy books from them. They still sell stuff that we publish, and they've done a great deal of good for freeing up creativity and intellectual discourse and dissent in the world. So no wonder the SPLC is after them.
The attacks on free speech lately, the sneaky way that free speech is being attacked lately, just sort of, as I say at the beginning of one of my articles for Trigger Warning, which, by the way, our new issue launched Monday, if I may plug it,
we're here plugging away. Yeah,
plugging away. Let's plug each other's backs. Wow, that sounded really perverted and weird, but scratch plug. As I said in my intro to a book review I did on the site, of an excellent book, by the way, Martin Van Creveld's Equality, The Impossible Quest, which is pretty much what it sounds like. It's an incredibly detailed historical look at the pathetic attempts that people have made to even the playing field over the millennia that humans have been around. And you know, his answer basically is, well, too bad, so sad, life's not fair. But it's so detailed that you know, there's a lot more in it than that. And highly recommended reading. Anyway, in my introduction to that, I wrote a little quip. I'm not optimistic enough to be either a socialist or a libertarian, but I sure would like to see government and big business kill each other in a knife fight. People have tried to describe my politics and my relationship to libertarianism. I'm I guess a bad libertarian. I think in theory the libertarian paradise sounds wonderful, but in reality, you know, some very stupid people start out with lots of money and do very well.
Let's talk about your politics, since you brought it up. You're a bad libertarian. What does that mean? You think there's certain areas where you would be happy to trim back individual liberty to create better social outcomes, or?
Oh, God, no.
Okay, so explain.
I sort of like Churchill, out of all the horrible economic systems we've tried, you know, free market capitalism is the least horrible. But I still think it's horrible. So I wouldn't say I'm pro-libertarian so much as I am very much more against everything else.
Okay, that makes sense. That makes sense. So what are some of the titles and authors you've brought out at Hopeless Books?
Our most recent is Black House Rocked, which is getting good reviews. I had a couple of authors approach me Paul Bingham, who was also published by Chip Smith at Nine Banded Books, and Chip sent me a review copy of his book, and I was like, wow, this is terrific. I love this guy. And Chip said, coincidentally, he has another story that we couldn't fit into the book of his that I published, which is called Down Where the Devil Don't Go. You know, I read that. I loved it. And Chip kind of sent Paul my way. And Paul brought along a friend of his called Emeril Kressel, Emeril Kressel, who is, you know, sort of a fledgling author that Paul wanted to, you know, help him get some ink. And, you know, at first I was like, oh God, I don't want to just print everybody's friends of friends of friends. You know, why don't I just join New York Publishing if that's the kind of cronyism I'm going to engage in. But I read Emeril's story, and it needed a little editing, but it was kind of a fantastically atmospheric story that really complemented Paul's story. And I thought, well, I had just gotten a new record player, and so I could, my turntable broke a while ago, and I had just gotten a new record player, and I was able to play all these old 45s and split singles that I had bought from punk rock labels in the 90s, and I was like, well, what if I put out a split single of literature and took these two authors that went really well together and were thematically linked, and that's where we came up with Black House Rocked, which it's, how best to describe it, clever, spooky, atmospheric. I'm terrifically proud to have published it.
Yeah, I thought it was terrific. I read James O'Meara's review that we published at Countercurrents and immediately ordered a copy of it, even though I was in Europe at the time. And so I got back on Friday, this past Friday, and, you know, I was exhausted and everything, and I read the whole thing. So it was it's quite compelling. I think Paul Bingham is a really good writer. I really enjoyed Down Where the Devil Don't Go. I haven't read the Kressel piece yet. I'll read it eventually, but I thought the Bingham piece was really, really compelling yeah. work.
Yeah, I mean, it just gets better as it goes along.
Yeah, he's a very talented writer. Again, he can be extremely hilariously un-PC. Mm-hmm. You know, we need to... there's a piece in Down Where the Devil Don't Go, which is the most vicious parody of... Well, it's really a parody, I guess, of Joss Whedon, who's somebody that I really like, and the kind of Hollywood shark types. And I just thought that was so vicious and so funny. Passed that around to quite a lot of people. I didn't get my copy back. I need to find out who has it. But yeah, it's good stuff. So anyway, speaking of New York Publishing, you were with Talkies Magazine for a while, right? So tell us about your stint as editor at Talkie Mag.
Well, that was a lot of fun. It lasted about a year. I'm not quite sure how it ended. I think Talkies and I got about as much as we were going to get out of each other at that point. It was interesting. I learned a lot. And I got to work with a lot of really, you know, great and interesting writers. But after a certain point, you can only edit the same writers so many weeks in a row.
Right. Who were your favorite people to work with?
Daniel Cole and or Stein. I always forget which
David
pen name
Cole.
He's
using. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And why do I always keep calling him Daniel? Good Lord. I'm terrible with people's names, by the way. I went to I grew up in a very small town in Wisconsin. My graduating class in high school was 23 people. So one intellectual skill I failed to pick up was learning people's names, because I had the same 23 names to learn. But anyway, David Cole was always fantastic to work with, clean copy, interesting stuff. Kathy Shadle was always a delight. People say nasty things about Gavin McInnes, but I found him to be really easy to work with. Not a prima donna. If something wasn't working, he was perfectly okay with yanking it or changing it. Just really nice to work with.
So tell us about Jim Goad. Do you know him? Did you work with him before you got the editing job?
Well, actually, I didn't really work with him. I mean, I got to know him through the application process, and, you know, we would talk every once in a while, but sort of the Taki's philosophy is, if you're an editor, you don't really need to be edited. So since he was the outgoing editor, I didn't edit him, and he didn't edit me. So if you're an editor, your stuff just, boom, it just hits the slopes, you know? He was always pleasant to me. Like I said, we weren't, you know, up to the elbows in work together, but it was a good experience working with him in general.
Why did he stop being editor, do you know?
He got offered a job that had health insurance.
Ah.
Yeah.
Okay.
He got offered a job that had health insurance at Thought Catalog. I don't know what his other reasons might have been, but that was the most obvious one. Mine, like I said, I felt like I had edited the same thing about a billion times in a row. And I was ready to start a new project.
Well, that's great. That's great. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing the new stuff that you write. Let's talk about a few people in the business, since I raised questions about people like Goad and so forth. And we mentioned David Cole. Chip Smith, I did an extensive interview with him a couple years ago at Countercurrents, just trying to get to know him. I really think he's a remarkable guy. I think Nine Banded Books is a noble, very quirky venture. Tell us a little bit about your friendship with him.
Chip is awesome. I met him, well, I didn't meet him face-to-face until we were in our 20s, but we were both writing zines back in the 90s. I don't know if your listeners, especially the younger ones, are going to know what a zine is, but zines were basically, well, they're much harder to do than blogs. You can't do them with just a click of a few buttons, but I guess they were sort of the rough equivalent of blogs before the internet took off. They were small magazines that you made yourself. If you got big enough, you might take them to a printer, but most of us just ran them off on the Xerox machines at Kinko's Copies, which, God, I haven't seen a Kinko's in years. That takes me back. But I really don't recall quite who ordered whose zine first, but we started communicating that way. And I was sort of a political nihilist at the time. I was a punk rocker, but over the years, Chip kept sending me a subscription to Reason magazine, trying to make me see the light of libertarianism, which, you know. Eventually, yeah, I came to accept that as the least horrible of all of our horrible systems. But, you know, he was never obnoxious or a proselytizing bastard about it. He also introduced me to the sort of theoretical underpinnings of what I've always felt, antinatalism, which is, you know, the idea that it's just simply morally wrong to bring children into this dubious little world we live in. I'd always had those sort of philosophical leanings, but I didn't know that there was a whole movement and an actual theory behind it till Chip introduced me to that. And like I said, he encouraged me to write Nusquam. I was sort of floundering in academic hell when he asked me for a manuscript. And currently, he's just about to publish my translation of Octave Mirbeau's In the Sky, which Octave Mirbeau was a semi-famous 19th century anarchist whose most famous book was Diary of a Chambermaid. The book that I just translated has never been seen before in English, and we shopped it around to a couple of publishers, and they were like, we don't know, Amazon's killing us, we don't know if we can take a chance on the 19th century, blah, blah, blah. And Chip was like, boom, if they don't want to do it, I want to do it. Because that's the kind of thing that Chip jumps into, you know, head first, both feet flailing. God bless him. And I mean that not in the condescending way. You know.
God help him. You don't mean it that way, right?
Yeah, yeah. I don't mean it in the sort of passive-aggressive Southern Belle way when they go, bless your little heart, and they mean you're an idiot. I mean good for him. He's the guy who jumps into this stuff.
Yeah, I think it's admirable to take risks doing stuff like that. Personally, I didn't start Countercurrents to be a non-profit entity, but it really has sort of turned out that way. But my major goal was to spread certain kinds of ideas and create books that I wish that I could have bought when I was 20. And, so I'm always just trying to imagine myself in the position of somebody who's bright and open-minded in their 20s, late teens even, and trying to figure out how to create the kind of books that I would have loved at that time in my life. And it seems to be working well. And I've just found that I don't have to make a profit as long as it breaks even, because I have people who believe in the same vision and they help me out with donations. So that's the way it works. And of course, I'd love to have a bestseller, and some of our books do definitely make a profit. Others, the poetry collections and things like that, I do just because these books deserve to be born. So I'm pronatalist about certain kinds of things. I definitely think certain books need to be born.
I'm pronatalist about a lot of books myself.
Yeah, I would like there to be more people around to appreciate them too. Andy Nowicki is a mutual friend of ours. We've both published him. Tell me a little bit about how you got to be his friend, his reader, his publisher.
Well, it's the Chip Smith connection. Chip published Andy's On Considering Suicide around the same time that he published Nusquam, I think. It was at least within a year of each other. Considering Suicide, I think, was one of Andy's first books. And Chip sent me a copy, because Chip sends copies of everything to everybody just because he wants stuff to get read. And I was intrigued by it. And Andy and I started talking on Facebook, and we had different opinions about a lot of specific things, but I noticed that he was the type of person who could disagree with you without being uncivil about it.
Right, right. He's very Catholic, and I'm not, and yet we have a very cordial relationship. But then I like a lot of Catholic writers like Flannery O'Connor and Walker Percy. They're very close to my heart, so... And I had a kind of Catholic, a very Catholic graduate education. So I appreciate that intellectual tradition, even though I'm not on board with it. And there's a broad-mindedness about it that I really appreciate.
Yeah. Yeah, I was raised Catholic, actually. So when Andy does his, I don't want to belittle it, but when he does his Catholic shtick, I mean that in the least belittling way possible, it really resonates with me because, some people will sneer, some true believers will sneer at the idea of being culturally Catholic, but, they say you can take the girl out of the church, but you can't take the church out of the girl. And, some things happened to me, fairly early in adolescence that sort of shook my faith and made it very nearly impossible for me to believe that there's any sense or justice in the universe. But culturally speaking, Catholic inflected work still resonates with me greatly. And the way Andy does it is he's not shoving it down your throat. And a lot of the struggles that his characters have with faith are very easily applied to any sort of struggle that people have with just believing whether life is worth going on with or believing in what you're doing. His work is very resonant to a wider audience, and I really don't think it would be fair to just slot him as a Catholic author. I mean, that's part of the engine that's turning his creative juices, but it's not the be-all and end-all, and you really don't have to be a Catholic to feel deeply touched by his work.
Yeah, I would agree with that completely. I have become somewhat skeptical of his turn towards talk about, writing about masturbation. It's hard to respect. It's hard to respect and hard to take seriously. It's hard to respect him as an adult male for writing this kind of really nebbishy stuff. And I have to say that I met him in person for the first time back in March. He came to Atlanta to see Tito Perdue's talk that we set up there. And I was surprised that he didn't conform at all to the image that he tries to present of a kind of nebbishy person. He's very tall. He was fit, nicely dressed, and poised. And I just thought, you know, this guy does not seem like the Andy Nowicki I would expect from this kind of writing about masturbation and, you know, being a proud loser and stuff like that. It struck me as incongruous for some reason. But anyway, whatever he's working through with these writings, I know that there are people who are working through it along with him. But it strikes me that he's beyond it, at least to all outward appearances, for what it's worth.
Yeah, in an interview with him, I believe I've discussed certain incongruities. Oh, I was asking him, you know, he professes this deep faith in all the teachings of the Catholic Church, but in his fictional universe, you know, there are things like demons, things that are very much outside of his belief system. And if I recall, his response to that was pretty much just, well, it's creativity, which I found to be an acceptable answer. I mean, it's not my business to tell people how to answer my questions. But I guess what I'm saying is it made sense. I mean, it's still a question that I'd like to hear him grilled slightly longer over. The sort of disconnect between his professed faith and what his fictional imaginary universe looks like. But yeah, I mean, if you were a nerd in high school, which I definitely was, you know, no matter what happens to you on the outside, there's still a part of you that's being stuffed in a dumpster.
Right, right. Yeah, maybe I'm just not being real myself about this. I mean, it was my high school too, but it's odd. I've forgotten so much. I tend to just forget unpleasant things, and maybe I don't want Andy to stir up any unpleasant memories, which is why sometimes I react negatively to this stuff. However, you know, you and I are part of the Andy Nowicki Publisher Club, along with Chip Smith, so it's because we like his work a lot, and I'm always reading whatever new stuff he brings out quite eagerly.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about one of our writers, James O'Meara. James is a person who, oddly enough, he didn't know that he was a literary critic until I told him he was. I said, James, you're a literary critic and a really good one. He says, really? I'm not a literary critic. I don't know what I am. I'm some smart-ass blogger. And I said, no, you're a literary critic. Listen, look at what you've written here and here and here. And I said, you know, I could use a good literary critic because there's this burgeoning field of edgetarian alt-right fiction out there, and you've got good taste and you can be fairly diplomatic when it's called for. Why don't you be our critic and sort of help this movement along? And so I know he's reviewed a couple of your books, a number of books you published. I just send anything his way.
But when I was writing reviews at Takis, and I think I'm going to continue writing reviews at Trigger Warning, the real trick, I think, with writing book reviews is, In the mainstream publishing world, there are so many blurbable book reviews out there, like, so-and-so has written the greatest, you know, novel about penguins since penguins were invented. And the usual way that people write reviews is in order to get their own words reprinted as blurbs. But, I mean, honest to God, who the hell is going to read that? Who wants to read 50 different reviews that are either, I liked this, or I did not like that? You know, if you want to really engage the audience with what the author is doing, and also with, you know, your own vision, you have to kind of give value for money as far as the entertainment value in your review goes. That's what I tried to do at Takis. That's what I'm trying to do at Trigger Warning. Trigger Warning is... it's a bit more of an open field it can go wherever we want it to go. So I've got a bit more freedom to just to develop the form of the literary review. But you know, keeping up with Omira is not an easy task, because he really doesn't seem to give a shit what you think about what he thinks. He's just going to say what he thinks. And it makes for really enjoyable reviews. And even if I don't get around to reading the book, at least I feel like I have a sense of what that book was about.
So, Anne, we've gone on for about an hour, so let's start wrapping up. Is there anything that you really would like to say before we get going? Any final thoughts? Any questions that you think I should have asked you?
Actually, I'm just going to finish answering a question that you asked me, and then I went off on a tangent.
Okay.
All these books that I've been writing, you know, I wrote Nusquam and the Talkative Corpse for their own sake, yes, but they were also sort of practice for writing my big science fiction novel, which I'm within a couple of chapters of actually completing. So, I've been stuck on it a while, but I'm kind of crawling through the mud toward the finish line right now. The book's name is Life, L-Y-F-E, and it's named after a drug that mysteriously makes some people die young in a horrible addictive situation, while it mysteriously makes other people immortal. And of course, it's set on a planet that Earthlings colonized far in the future. But as I am not an optimist, the spaceship barely limped to this planet as we were destroying our own planet, and we couldn't figure out how to get any further than that, so we're kind of stuck. So, and that book actually does have a female protagonist, because you're hardly going to write a science fiction novel that's pure autobiography.
Right, yeah, if you're going to create an entire alternative universe and new technology and stuff like that, hell, you might as well stay closer to home in other areas.
Yeah, make it easy on yourself in one spot, at least.
Yeah, exactly. That makes perfect sense. That makes perfect sense. Well, Anne, thank you so much. This has been great. I really wish you all the best with Trigger Warning and with Hopeless Books and with this new novel.
Yay! Well, thank you so much. I've enjoyed our interview.
Great. Well, I hope this is just the first of many conversations. Thank you.